Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and a special thanks to everyone who tuned into our previous episode that was dedicated to Kiss's Hotter Than Hell, with my special guest Beth Blade, lead singer of Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters. It's an episode that went down really well, and I got a lot of amazing feedback from kind of the Kiss Army, the online Kiss Army, some fantastic Kiss groups and other Kiss podcasts, really giving me some fantastic feedback on that episode of My Classic Album. And I have been speaking to a couple of other people that would like to cover a Kiss album in the future. We'll probably leave that for a few months. We don't want to get kind of too bogged down with one artist, but it was really nice to hear everybody's thoughts on Hotter Than Hell and Kiss in general, a band that sometimes are a bit overlooked as being a bit gimmicky, but I hope that Beth and I kind of were able to dig into that a bit for you and see that perhaps they're not necessarily the joke band that some people think they are. But that was last month. This month, we're going to be looking at Tapestry by Carole King, one of the best-selling albums of all time, one of the most popular albums of all time, and an album that's very different to Hotter Than Hell in a lot of ways. But that's the beauty of My Classic Album, that as our guests choose the albums, we can go off in all sorts of different directions. And my special guest today is Ashton Lane's Esther O'Connor. For those who don't know, Ashton Lane are a fantastic country band from Scotland, and Esther is the singer in that band. And we sat down and we had a really nice chat about Tapestry just a couple of months ago. And that's what you're going to be hearing just a little bit later on in the podcast. And also, in just a moment, I'm going to be talking about the new album from Lindsay Buckingham and Christine McVie. Now, I know a lot of you really enjoyed our 40 Years of Rumours podcast back in February, so I'm sure that you'll be quite interested, if you haven't heard the album already, to hear what this new album, the kind of the Fleetwood Mac album that isn't, is all about. So I'll be talking about that in just a little bit. But speaking of 40 Years of Rumours, I am actually going to be slipping in a very similar episode next month. Now, anyone who listened to last month's podcast or followed the social media pages know that I was talking about doing a different episode in August. We were going to do a My Classic Discography episode on the music of Queen. And that episode is still coming, but it's going to get pushed back a little bit to make way for a special episode that we're going to be doing in August. So I received a message a few weeks ago from Rob Wild, who is the lead singer of glam metal band Tiger Tales. And he really enjoyed our Hotter Than Hell episode, and he really wanted to get involved. He wanted to appear on My Classic Album. And if you're a band or a singer and you want to get involved in the podcast, the best way to do that is get yourself over to Facebook, if you've got it, and search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and just send me a message. I am on Twitter as well, at @MCA_podcast, and on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast. And just let me know that you want to get involved. So Rob and I chatted for a little bit, and Rob was really interested in doing an episode of My Classic Album around Def Leppard's Hysteria. Now, if you were to go over to myclassicalbum.co.uk and have a look at an article called Mike's 20 Classic Albums, you would see that Hysteria is actually in there. In fact, I'd say it's my third favourite album of all time. Third only to Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf and Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses. So you get a flavour of the sort of music that I like to listen to when I'm not doing the podcast. So it didn't take me a lot of persuasion to agree to do Hysteria for August's edition. The reason that I've done it in August rather than leaving it to later in the year is because August will mark the 30th anniversary of Hysteria. So we will still be doing My Classic Discography at some point in the next few months, but August is now going to be 30 years of Hysteria, and my guest, as I touched upon there, is Tiger Tales frontman Rob Wild. So that'll be up from the 1st of August, and in a similar vein to when we did 40 Years of Rumours, I want to hear your thoughts on this album. So get yourself onto Facebook, My Classic Album with Mike Norris, get yourself on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast, or get yourself onto Twitter at @MCA_podcast and let me know your thoughts on Def Leppard's Hysteria. Send me a message, leave it on the wall. I think there is a Facebook post floating around with the album cover on, and I'm asking people's thoughts on it. And the best ones will get read out on next month's edition of My Classic Albums. That's going to be 30 Years of Hysteria with Tiger Tales frontman Rob Wild. So before we dive into Tapestry, it seemed like a really cool, opportune time to have a look at the new album from Lindsay Buckingham and Christine McVie. Yeah, obviously we're talking about Rumours and 40 Years of Rumours. You know, that album is 40 years old, and yet Fleetwood Mac are still going strong in one way or another. It looked like for a long time that the next kind of Fleetwood Mac album would have all five of those guys on. But for some reason, Stevie Nicks wasn't particularly interested in getting involved in the album. She was more interested in touring. And so this album, although it is Lindsay Buckingham and Christine McVie, has Mick Fleetwood, has John McVie on the album. So it is essentially a Fleetwood Mac album, but it's not. I'd be interested. I mean, I guess that they kind of feel that they didn't want to release a Fleetwood Mac album without Stevie on it, and perhaps that's a wise move. It may have sold more if it did have that Fleetwood Mac tag on it, but it was just, it's been interesting. I've been thinking about it for a long time. As soon as I heard that it was happening, it was something I thought, ooh, this is really interesting. You know, what's this going to be like? Essentially, it is a duet album, which sounds like a really kind of obvious thing to say. But I think that when you listen to some Fleetwood Mac albums, you can tell. So Tusk is a really good example, that Tusk is like Lindsey Buckingham's baby. It's, you know, we talked about this a bit in February, that it's very much what he wanted to do. The sound that he was dictating was what appeared on that album. I don't get the sense when I listen to this album that any one person's kind of dominating the sound of the album, what it's going to be. It very much feels like a duet album. It feels like that Lindsey Buckingham and Christine McVie have come together to create this album. And in that sense, I would argue that it's not a Fleetwood Mac album. It certainly has a lot of traits to it, because you've got four members of the band who have contributed to the album. But it is very much an album on its own that you can kind of set aside. So I guess the question is it any good? Is it a good album? And, you know, when I'm kind of discussing albums on the podcast, I don't tend to bring ones that I dislike. So, you know that if I'm going to be talking about an album, that I'm going to be recommending it, or at the very least that I've found something of merit with it. It's interesting because I was very interested when I heard that the album was coming out. And I think In My World was the first one that they leaked, which was kind of do the older bands do singles anymore? You know, maybe they just kind of release songs on and let you kind of get a feel for the album. But In My World was written by Lindsey Buckingham on lead vocal. And I wasn't sure. I really wasn't. And I listened to it a couple of times and I was like, I'm not sure how I feel about this. This seems a bit strange. And then I was looking in kind of comments on kind of Fleetwood Mac pages, and a lot of people were talking about the production. They felt it was overproduced. But that song is, it's a grower. It's a real grower. And then, you know, one day I'd be at work and I would find myself kind of singing the chorus. And I thought, well, you know, maybe this isn't as bad as I thought it was. And I went back and listened to it again. So it's a grower. It really is. So if you've listened to that song and it's kind of put you off listening to the album, I would thoroughly recommend that you return to it, because there's some really, really cool stuff on there. It sounds daft, but even the sequencing of the album, so you've kind of got a Lindsey song, a Christine song, Lindsey, Christine, all the way through the album, through the 10 tracks. So although, yeah, I feel like there's parts of Rumours where Lindsey really dominates, where you have like a few songs of his in a row, this is kind of really spaced out. It gives both of them a really nice chance to shine. And there's just some really nice songs here. When you bear in mind that, you know, it's 40 years since this defining album that we've been talking about, and obviously a lot of people have been talking about this year, the fact that these guys can sing and write at the level that they are still is absolutely phenomenal. A personal favourite track for me is probably the opening track, Sleeping Around the Corner. It's another one that just really stuck in my head. I really liked it. And I mean, if you have listened to 40 Years of Rumours that we did in February, you'll know that I'm a huge Lindsey Buckingham fan. You know, I love the way he writes. I love his voice. So for me, it makes sense that the Lindsey songs would stand out for me more than Christine's. But I don't want to give disservice to Christine's songs on the album, because they are absolutely fantastic. And what's cool is that, you know, you've got some, you know, for example, Too Far Gone, that they've written together and that Christine's kind of taken the lead on. So it's just really, it's going to sound weird. It's a real nice, like most Fleetwood Mac albums, it's just lovely just to have on and just kind of listen to it all the way through as an album. And that's the joy of having it on vinyl. And that's why when we talk about kind of albums on my classic album, I like to get them on vinyl, because it's something about listening through to an album from start to finish as it was intended, rather than kind of picking little sections out. So this is a great album that from Sleeping Around the Corner right through to Carnival Begin that you can listen to. It can be on in the background, you can be listening intently, and you know, like all Fleetwood Mac albums, there's something there for everyone. Mick Fleetwood's on drums, John McVie on bass. It is essentially Fleetwood Mac, but it feels different. And I don't think that's just because Stevie's not there. I think it's simply because there's this kind of collaborative effort to make it more of a duets album than a group album. And you know, there might be some people who disagree with me there and think that it's, you know, because in some ways it is the Fleetwood Mac album that never was, but I personally think it deserves a bit more credit than that. It's done really well in the charts, and it's out now, so you know, absolutely pick it up if you are into Fleetwood Mac, if you're into Lindsey Buckingham and Christine McVie's solo craze, or if you just want something that's an easy listen. No one's trying too hard, no one's trying to make anything seem more than it is. It's just a great album between two, if not four people, you know, that have worked together for a long time. And it just really shows. It's slick. And it's just, it's these guys at their best. That's all I can say, really. And I know that obviously they'll be their turn at the moment in America. And then obviously there's been this big news this month that Stevie Nicks has confirmed that Fleetwood Mac will be touring together next year. So, you know, I certainly would have no issue if they performed a couple of these songs on that tour, because they are really strong. So yeah, Lindsey Buckingham, Christine McVie is out now. And yeah, I would love to know your thoughts on it. So get on those pages and just let me know what you think about this album. Okay, so I think I've talked enough. Let's get into Tapestry. Tapestry by Carole King is today's classic album. And my special guest Esther O'Connor will be here in just a minute to break that down for us. But before we get to Esther, here's everything you need to know about Tapestry. February 10th, 1971 saw the release of Tapestry, the second studio album from American singer-songwriter Carole King. The album was recorded at AMM Recording Studios in California throughout January 1971 and was produced by Lou Adler, who released Tapestry on his label Ode Records. Carole King already had a successful career as one half of a songwriting partnership with ex-husband Jerry Goffin. Tapestry came off the back of King's debut album Writer and included Goffin and King compositions already made famous by other artists, as well as songs written by King following her divorce. A double A-side of I Feel the Earth Move and It's Too Late was released in April 1971 and reached number 1 on the US Billboard charts, while reaching number 6 in the UK. So Far Away and Smack Water Jack achieved similar success, settling in at number 14 on the Billboard Hot 100. It's Too Late particularly received strong recognition, winning the Grammy Award for Record of the Year in 1972, while Rolling Stone called it the 469th greatest song of all time in 2004. Tapestry itself became a phenomenal success on its release, as it stayed at number 1 on the Billboard 200 for 15 consecutive weeks, while reaching number 4 in the UK. Carole King still holds the record for most consecutive weeks at number 1 for a female solo artist, thanks to Tapestry, and the album is certified diamond in the US for sales in excess of 10 million copies. Critically, the album received rave reviews from the very beginning, the best example of this being at the 1972 Grammy Awards, when Tapestry won 4 Grammys, including Album of the Year. In 2003, VH1 named Tapestry 39th in its 100 Greatest Albums, while Rolling Stone placed 36th in their 500 Greatest Albums of All Time. In that same year, Tapestry was chosen to be added to the National Recording Registry, one of 50 recordings deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically important in the United States. So that's just the beginning of what you need to know about Tapestry, and I have here with me my special guest who chose this album, Esther O'Connor. How's it going?
Hello, good, thanks, Mike.
So I guess the best place to start, and it's the first question I ask everybody, is why have you chosen Tapestry specifically to talk about today on My Classic Album?
So the reason I chose Tapestry is, for me, it's a masterclass in songwriting. I do think Carole King's probably one of our greatest female singer-songwriters. She's a hero to all female singer-songwriters, I think. And she's certainly a hero of mine. And I think there's just an honest, soulful, just an amazing quality to her songwriting. It's very natural. She's not contrived. She just tells it from the heart. And she's just unbelievably talented. Like, her ear for melody and lyric is incredibly inspiring. So that's my reasons.
Just before we get into kind of the nitty-gritty of it all, what are your kind of first experiences of kind of listening to Carole King, particularly this album?
So my parents, probably like a lot of people, when I grew up, my parents had a good vinyl collection, and Tapestry was among those vinyls, and that's really where I fell in love with it. There was various albums along the way of a similar era, and people like James Taylor, who's been a favourite, and I know is obviously a contemporary and a friend of Carole King. And so, and a lot of music from Carole King and James Taylor sort of became a backdrop to our family life. So dinners, you know, we would have usually those albums on while we were having dinner or just hanging out in the kitchen, you know. So it really has, it's a very emotive album to me, because, you know, I think about growing up when I listen to it. Even though it's an album from the 70s, it reminds me of my childhood as well.
So although Tapestry was only Carole King's second album, she'd been half of a songwriting partnership with her husband, Jerry Goffin, throughout the 60s. Do you know a lot about that kind of professional relationship she had with Jerry?
Just a little bit, I suppose. And I know she talks about him, you know, when you hear, and she talks, as she does about everybody, she talks very, very warmly about him. So, just a wee bit, I suppose. And I know she had a lot of people cover her songs, you know, prior to, I think when she worked at, was it the Brill Building, as a songwriter, was that in the 50s even, or early 60s? And obviously had cuts with people prior to releasing her own material as well.
So I know you talk about kind of the writing songs for so many other artists. Some of the ones I've got here, they wrote The Locomotion. They wrote, they wrote Chains, which was later covered by the Beatles on Please Please Me. Up on the Roof by the Drifters.
Yeah.
And You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman for Aretha Franklin, which, of course, actually appears on the end of Tapestry.
Yes.
Do you think they're one of the forgotten songwriting partnerships of the 60s, or do you think they get their due?
I think they probably get their due. I mean, Carole King always strikes me, whenever I see her interviewed or hear her gig and perform, as an incredibly humble person. Like, for all her phenomenal success, I think she's a very earthy person, and she seems to really kind of, I don't know, care about the things that really matter in life. And I remember hearing a story about her once that she didn't go to the Grammys or something like that because she was like away in her ranch somewhere and just couldn't face, you know, that life in a way, and just felt comfortable closer to home and, you know, with her, you know, around more natural environments. For me, I kind of think that sort of sums Carole King up, like that, you know, she seems like a kind of, I don't know, a natural person, a natural woman.
And I mean, that being said, while Carole King was primarily a songwriter at this point, she did have a couple of hit singles in her own right. So most notably, It Might As Well Rain Till September. So at this early stage in her career, do you think she was happy being just a songwriter with Jerry? Or do you think that she had aspirations to become an artist in her own right?
That I'm not sure. I haven't heard her talk about that in particular. But I seem to get the impression with Carole King that the success of the album and her as an artist seemed to slightly take her by surprise. I don't know if I'm right about that, but I don't know, I suppose just that's my impression of her, is that she, I'm not sure whether I'm right, but that's just always been my impression, is that, you know, I suppose she had all these great songs, but that perhaps it slightly took her by surprise. But that's just my impression. I don't know if that's true or not.
So, I mean, some of these songs that she wrote in the 60s and became big hits for other singers did make her way onto her debut album, Writer, as well as a couple on Tapestry itself. So, Bob Stanley of The Guardian wrote that with Writer and Tapestry, here were Carole King's versions of the Carole King 1960s songbook. It was time to move on, alone this time. Do you think that these songs, such as Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow and You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, were a kind of catharsis for her when her marriage ended in the late 60s to be able to perform these songs?
Oh, quite probably. I mean, I think for any songwriter, you know, music is how you process all those events of your life, and I would imagine Carole King's the same. And I think you find, especially when you go through difficult times, whether it's a death or a marriage breakup or some time of grieving, for me, when I've gone through these times, music has been so healing, and it really helps you to process what's going on, and I certainly find it cathartic and very therapeutic. I imagine she was the same.
Fast forward a few years, Carole and Jerry are divorced, and she's moved to Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles, where she meets the likes of Joni Mitchell and James Taylor.
Yep.
So when you and I were discussing what album we'd talk about, it was a really weird coincidence, because you gave me four albums. Yeah. And the other three, I'd literally recorded interviews for those three albums. So those albums were Rumours, Blue, and Sweet Baby James. So if we take Rumours out of the equation for a second, the other two albums, as I say, we've covered them very recently. What is it about that particular time in American music and that particular, I guess, movement in California that speaks so much to you?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I sometimes imagine what it must have been like to have been involved at that unbelievably creative time. And I suppose, also the cultural shift that was happening, and the music was all part of that, and there was quite a wide group, I suppose, of just so many creative people writing some of the best music that, in my opinion, we've had really in modern times. You know, some of for me these you know, all these years later, they still are the classic albums, and you know, sold millions upon millions of copies each of them. And I don't know, I'm not sure exactly how to sum it up, but it must have been the most incredible experience to have been part of it. And sometimes when I listen to these albums, whether it's Blue, and obviously Joni Mitchell's that different personality, a more melancholy personality possibly, and you've got James Taylor, who's just so unique. And but there's something about all of them where when they sing, they create an atmosphere and they kind of take you somewhere with their stories. I think with Carole King and Through Tapestry, there's a sense of kind of longing and you know, wanting to be home, and some of these universal feelings. And I think through that whole album she sort of expresses that emotion and that feeling that I just think so many people connect to. Joni Mitchell in her own way expresses that through Blue, and Sweet Baby James is the same. There's what is the quality about James Taylor? It's almost undefinable. Like when you put on a classic James Taylor album, what it is that you feel is like, I don't know. It's hard to put it into words, I suppose.
And I mean, you've touched on this yourself, this huge collaborative, creative friendship between all these artists. So yeah. It's like, just for saying, for anyone who's kind of unaware, so James Taylor's playing on Blue, Carole King's playing on Sweet Baby James, Joni Mitchell's singing background vocals on Tapestry. Yeah. So it's this really kind of creative hub. And it's like you say, this idea of that you can just imagine them all kind of sitting around together and yeah, kind of throwing ideas at each other almost.
I know, that's it.
Carole King said about their friendship, and it's just an interesting kind of quote, that we were a community of people with a similar choice of career, similar influences, similar interests, and a similar drive to have our music be heard by millions of people. An astonishing number of us achieved that. And it seems more like a creative collective that nurtured each other rather than kind of trying to one-up each other and being competitive.
Yeah, that's a lovely point. And do you know, it's something I think about actually sometimes is, I don't know, I think that attitude's very important, and I wonder how much that had to do with each of their success. And, you know, I suppose, right, to see the absolute polar opposite of the spectrum where you see something like The Voice or American Idol and some of these kinds of things where it's like, you know, there's one winner and you're all competing against each other. And actually it creates a really horrible narrative, I suppose, you know, where... Whereas it's not as if with Carole King, Joni Mitchell and James Taylor, you're going to like one and not like the other. You know, there's a sense of abundance, and there's a sense of like, there's plenty to go around. There's plenty of, you know, there's plenty of people who love music. There's plenty of creativity. There's plenty of space. And, you know, obviously there's three notable ones, but there was lots and lots of others, Jackson Brown. And, you know, there's many others you could mention that were, you know, in a similar camp. Bob Dylan doing his own thing as well, you know. And I think that's very different, you know, in a way to some of what we see in our modern age, particularly in the mainstream, is just that. And I think that's so important. And it's something as a creative person and as a musician that I want to nurture with the other musicians that I'm involved with, is the sense that we're here to support one another. We're here to creatively invest in what each other does and to help one another where you can, and not be like competitive. And you know, I think that's a very important thing to point out.
Yeah. And just a quote from a series called American Masters, which kind of sums all this up. And yeah, it's similar to, I was talking to Bruce Carroll, and he, in American Masters, they say about this particular time in music, the glory days of worshipping bands such as Love, Buffalo Springfield and The Doors were fading into a narcotic distance. The deaths of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison's was yet to come, the ongoing horror of Vietnam, and the breakup of the Beatles all contributed to a subtle but clear change that made the audience desire a different relationship with the music. And it's that kind of thing, and I asked this to Bruce, is do you think that in the early 70s, all these musicians were kind of coming to terms with the fact that the 60s were over, it was kind of a brave new world, and they were trying to kind of come to terms with that themselves?
Yeah, I mean, for us, that's something that I've thought about in the past, actually, as well, is, do you know, even the word, say, for instance, the word fan, you know, it's kind of short for, like, fanatic. And you're like, I don't know about you, but when I'm into a band or I love a band or want to support a band, I don't necessarily feel like I'm fanatical about them, or, you know, it's a sort of idol worship type thing, you know. I think for me, the real vocation of musicians, and this is something you see in Carole King, James Taylor, Joni Mitchell and others, is that they're storytellers and that they communicate, you know, something of the heart of what it is to be human. And I think, you know, I went to see James Taylor not too long ago in Glasgow, a couple of years ago in Glasgow. And, you know, you're not like idol worshipping. I just cried all the way through the gig because it was so emotive. And, you know, I love that Troubadour. I've got the Troubadour DVD of Carole King and James Taylor doing their collaborative thing. And it just makes me like cry just listening to them. And that's a very different experience from being kind of like, you know, like idol worshipping a band, whether it's, you know, Justin Bieber fans in this day and age or what's the One Direction, things like that, or, you know, however it was back in the 60s. But, you know, where there's an artist that their vocation is really communicating the very important stories of our lives. And that to me is where I connect with the musicians that I love, you know, is where you really connect on a human level. They're doing their job well and singing and writing songs and that make you feel and really affect you. And that's certainly, I think, a healthier relationship to have with musicians rather than the kind of rock god type thing.
Absolutely. I think there is something about genre there as well when you've touched on rock god. So it's that kind of thing that, and I mean, I like all sorts of genres of music, but I do love like rock and hard rock. And it is the idea that, you know, when you think about kind of the classic guitarists and singers that have come and go over the years, and there is this almost kind of adulation with them.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
But whereas I guess with a singer-songwriter, it's easier to kind of sit down and kind of appreciate the music and appreciate the message rather than the spectacle, I guess.
I know. Yes, that's true. And, you know, there's a place for all, I suppose. You know, there's like, you know, big rock shows are great fun and, you know, that's cool. But I suppose it's still the relationship element in a way, you know, and what it is your relationship to that musician or whatever. And I certainly think, you know, I suppose, as you pointed out earlier, people like Janis Joplin and Hendrix and Bolan and people like that, you do wonder, you're like, was that good for you? Like, was that adulation actually extremely unhealthy? And I suppose you see it in this day and age as well, like where people have that kind of adulation and it seems to really disturb them in a way, you know. So I'm not sure that's always very healthy anyway.
No, absolutely. And I think that translates into the music. So, I mean, Tapestry, it's a much more intimate approach to music than pretty much anything we'd seen before. Uh-huh. And James Taylor talked to Billboard about Carole's transition from a songwriter to almost a singer front and centre. And he said she decided to own her voice, no gauze on the lens, no affected technique, writing from her own personal experience and her own heart. She was herself. It read as being absolutely sincere and it connected. Do you feel that Tapestry is kind of the culmination of this kind of journey from songwriter to almost singer-songwriter of the masses, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, that was kind of what I said right at the beginning of the podcast as well, is that it's her sincerity. That's exactly, James Taylor put it perfectly. And you feel her soul, if that doesn't sound too cheesy. Like, you feel her, you know, what she's about in that album. It is totally sincere. It's totally honest. I think that sincerity, that unaffectedness. She's not trying to be anything. She's not trying to be anything different. She's not trying to be anybody else. She's just singing her songs and, you know, and it's very beautiful. Like, and it does just deeply connect with people, which is, I think, why it's responsible for its massive success.
Absolutely. Now seems as good a time as any just to go track by track. So the first track on the album, I Feel the Earth Move, is a hugely successful song in its own right. It was half of a double A-side with It's Too Late, which, again, we'll touch on in a little bit. Together, they became two of the biggest hits of 1971. Mm-hmm. And they reached number one on the Billboard charts, number six here in the UK. Mm-hmm. James Perrone praised the direction from producer Lou Adler to highlight King's piano high in the mix. Do you think that piano-dominated sound on the album helps it stand out next to a more acoustic guitar-driven album, like, say, Sweet Baby James?
It probably did, I think. And I think it's Carole's primary instrument. So I think that's an important way to go, because ultimately she could sit and sing that entire album to you on her own and it would be great. So I definitely think that makes sense.
It's a very upbeat song, and one that, in comparison to the rest of the album, has and I'm wording this carefully here, it has like a sexual element without being too like seedy or raunchy.
Yeah.
So AllMusic critic Stuart Mason describes the song as the ultimate in hippie chick eroticism and writes that it sounds like the unleashing of an entire generation of soft-spoken college girls' collective libidos. Do you think this is an important song in terms of a generation feeling able to talk openly about sex without being judged?
Could be, yeah. I mean, I suppose these songs do reflect part of what was happening in the wider culture at the time. So, could be.
I think it's something about how lyrically it's more about kind of the emotional side of love and sexuality rather than the physical side, which I think kind of makes it more real. So there's so many songs these days where it's like, you know, we were talking about kind of sort of current music earlier on, and it's this idea that songs that are kind of overtly sexual, it's in a way that kind of disassociates emotion from it. Whereas I Feel the Earth Move is completely the opposite. It's very much about emotion, although it's a sexual song.
I know. And I think it's probably a both and I think that probably sums Carol up as well, is that she certainly seems to me like, you know, quite a kind of integrated person, and, you know, I think that's it. I think that's a healthy attitude towards, you know, love and sex and relationships, is that they're not disassociated, those things, you know, love and relationships is not disassociated from sex. And I think that's something which, you know, when that happens, is can be deeply destructive, you know. And again, I think that's part of Carol's, she is earthy. You know, she's like, she communicates that, and even in Natural Woman and in another way, she communicates that same thing where you feel her sexuality, but it's not in any sort of tacky way or cheap way, but it's all just part of who she is, which, again, I mean, it wouldn't be holistic to be a person and disassociate that part of yourself, disassociate, you know, the physical, sexual side of yourself and only be emotional, for instance. So, and I think, again, that's just Carol, isn't it, where it's, you know, these things seem pretty well integrated, and I think you feel that in the album. There's like a nice womanly, earthy quality about it too.
Now, James Perrone, who we were discussing just earlier there, he goes on to say that the fast tempo on I Feel the Earth Move mirrors the joy and exhilaration felt in the lyrics. Do you think that's a good example of just how talented she is as a musician as well as a lyricist?
Yes, as a short answer.
So we'll move on to track two, which is So Far Away. Yep. So this is one of the songs, one of many songs on Tapestry, to feature James Taylor on acoustic guitar. And it's an instant contrast to a song like I Feel the Earth Move. AllMusic's Bill Janovitz identifies that the song drifts from talking about a physical distance between two lovers to talking about a more emotional distance. Do you think it would be safe to say, I mean, obviously, we're not Carole King, we can't say for sure, but do you think it's safe to say that we can maybe link the lyrics in this song to her feelings during and following the breakdown of her marriage in the late 60s?
It could be. I mean, I don't know whether this is right or not, but I also think about when I listen to a song like So Far Away, like what it's like as a musician away on the road a lot, and, you know, away from the people you love. And I've also thought about that song too, in terms of, you know, when she sings like, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? And like, I think that there's quite a few songs in this where there's that, as you said earlier, like that longing for home. And, you know, I think a lot of people feel that, like, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? And, you know, sometimes we long for stability and roots and knowing people and family and community and all those kinds of things. And, you know, and that special person as well or whatever. And I think all of us in one sense have a hunger for that. And she, I think that for me, when I listen to that song, I think songs are like pieces of art sometimes, so you can, you know, one person might read something, one person read another thing, but that's kind of what I feel when I listen to that song, it communicates that longing we have for home and for being found in that place.
One of the biggest links between Tapestry and the other albums we've been talking about, like Blue and Sweet Baby James, is drummer Russ Kunkel, who appears on several tracks of this album, including So Far Away. A Rolling Stone review of the album upon its release called Kunkel the best California session drummer since Hal Blaine, who drives the arrangement with the kind of power other drummers dream about. Do you find the inclusion of people like Kunkel and Danny Kochmar on this, and as well, you know, Sweet Baby James and these other albums, do you feel that they kind of enhance the overall sound of these albums?
I'm sure they do. Like, whatever it is, it just works so well, you know. So I think that, again, recording when in the time that Tapestry was recorded was a very, probably a pretty different experience to what it tends to be like now, and you know, everything's a bit more isolated. And I think they really had to get, you know, the players had to just be absolutely, there was not a lot of fixing able to happen in the same way, so the players really had to just be brilliant. And I think there was probably more of a focus on catching, you know, the performance and catching the, you know, that was the take, that was the time that the magic happened. You know, it was a bit more like that.
Absolutely. And it's like you say, it's going back to that kind of collaborative process, that it's not just kind of the big names like Joni Mitchell and James Taylor that are collaborating on these albums. It's kind of the, for lack of a better term, kind of the session musicians who kind of are working, you know, they're all good friends, they're all collaborating together, and it kind of creates this really almost fertile creative.
Exactly. Yeah. And every person is as important, you know, as the other person, kind of thing, you know.
Absolutely. And that's not, of course, to belittle Carole's contributions. So yeah. The same Rolling Stone review said of So Far Away, the simplicity of the singing, composition, and ultimate feeling achieved the kind of eloquence and beauty that I'd forgotten rock is capable of.
Yeah.
Now, I'd argue you could probably say that about the whole album, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I think so.
And that's just the beginning of our chat with Esther O'Connor about Carole King's amazing album Tapestry. So coming up in just a little bit, what event inspired Carole King to write You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman for Aretha Franklin? And which track on the album was rewritten for the TV series Gilmore Girls? All that and more right after this.
They'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on My Classic Album? Or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast. And who knows, you could be chatting with me very soon about your classic album.
Now for me, it's the music that gets me with this one. It's just beautifully put together, in my opinion.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
So if we move on to track 3, which is It's Too Late.
Yeah.
So the lyrics of It's Too Late were written by lyricist Toni Stern.
Right, yeah.
About the end of her relationship with James Taylor. So Carole King kind of gave a bit of background on this last year when she was talking to the Telegraph. She said, Toni was wonderful help with the transition from writing with Jerry to writing songs on my own. I didn't have the courage initially. I don't know about you, but do you find that kind of almost maddening, almost crazy that kind of Carole King would have such heavy doubts about her ability as a lyricist?
Yeah, I do find that a surprise, actually. I hadn't read that before. I suppose it's encouraging because I think every artist does feel that, and you sometimes think with these greats, like, how could they ever feel insecure about their talent? And, you know, to hear her say she didn't even feel that confident to write by herself. And I think when you've been part of a creative team, it can merge together, but it can merge so much that you don't really know whether the magic happens on your own, you know? Like, is it, or how much is it the other person, or how much is it purely the sum of the two parts, and you know, my talent on its own doesn't cut it, you know. So I can understand it, and I think it's quite crazy to hear her say that.
So it's regarded by many, It's Too Late, as one of the greatest breakup songs of all time.
Yeah.
So music critic Robert Christgau, who, it's funny, whenever I always look at his stuff, I always think he's very hard to please. But yeah. He'd claimed that if there's a truer song about breaking up, then It's Too Late. The world isn't ready for it.
Yeah.
Which I think is strong praise indeed. Would you kind of agree with that sentiment of kind of how big and important a breakup song it is?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So the success of the song is startling. So it was originally the B-side of I Feel the Earth Move. However, DJs started to prefer the slower It's Too Late. And eventually that was being played far more than its A-side. So Billboard then declared the single a double A-side, and the rest is history. Do you particularly have a preference between the two songs?
I prefer It's Too Late. I love them both, but I prefer It's Too Late, yeah.
So with that in mind, what is it about this song, bearing in mind that it won the Grammy Award for Record of the Year, Rolling Stone named it 469 on its 500 greatest songs of all time. What is it about that song that makes it so iconic?
Again, I mean, I know I'm probably repeating myself, but again, for me, it comes down to Carole's sincerity, and I think you feel her soft heart in that song, and, you know, so many people, it's just a connect thing, so many people connect to that experience that you tried, but it was too late, you know, and I think when you write a song that's so universally understood, you know, then that really does, it is really a recipe for success in a way, you know, because it's just so widely felt, that emotion so widely felt.
We'll move on to Home again. So The Guardian wrote about Tapestry last year to celebrate the fact that she was performing the album in full at Hyde Park last year. Uh-huh. And they used Home Again as a strong example of the album. They'd said, Tapestry is a strange kind of balm, full of secret sorrow. When she sings, Sometimes I Wonder If I'm Ever Gonna Make It Home Again, is she referencing the New York where she grew up, married and raised a family? Is she singing about Jerry Goffin, slowly recovering from a breakdown? Or is she singing about the 60s, a home that was lost to everyone with the passage of time? So with that in mind, do you think, and when I read this, it made me hark back to Sweet Baby James, which I guess is, that's going to happen when they're all kind of recorded together and in this same kind of time period. And a lot of Sweet Baby James was him kind of looking back at a difficult time in his life and reflecting that in his music. What I've said there, with that in mind, do you agree that maybe that's what Tapestry is as well? That she's obviously been through a lot in previous years and she's kind of still picking up the pieces and coming to terms with it all?
Yeah, I think quite possibly. And I think it sums up what a lot of us feel at times where, you know, we are in the middle of our lives and there's good bits and bad bits, but sometimes there's an undefinable longing for something, and, you know, and sometimes that's defined as home. And I think for me, Home Again is probably sort of a pretty pivotal track in the album in a way. And I think a lot of great albums have a sort of a theme, not like every song's about the same thing, but that as a piece it's communicating something. And I think for me, this album and Carole, what she's communicating, I think, through this album is that longing for home. I think So Far Away communicates that as well. And just, again, so many people experience that, and sometimes it's a home we might not have ever known. Like, it's not like necessarily there was ever an idyllic point in our lives where we were perfectly happy, but that there's something in all of us that does kind of hunger for that, where things are okay, where, you know, where we feel good, where we feel right. And I think, you know, when I've heard her talk about, you know, she had a ranch and she had her horses, and, you know, like, there was obviously something there that she, you know, that again, she felt peaceful there, whatever it was. And, you know, and I think, again, that's a very universal theme. I think all of us feel that at different times in our life, where there's a hunger for that home, wherever that is.
Yeah. So if we move on to Beautiful. So in her own memoir in 2012, Carole King said that Beautiful came to her spontaneously after realising on the New York subway that the way she perceived others reflected how she felt about herself. So I find this a really positive song. It's the idea that you're as beautiful as you feel. We've been talking a lot about the themes on the album already. Do you think that this theme of kind of inner beauty and self-esteem and empowerment, they're a big part of the album, yeah?
Yeah, I think they are as well. I mean, I think, again, that the Beautiful song for me is also, you know, as we've been talking about with Carole, you know, her being a natural woman in a way that, again, it's that uncontrived beauty that, you know, she doesn't, like, her herself, it's like, you know, she's not, even as an older woman now, like, she's so beautiful still, and, like, but there's something about her just sort of glows. And I think, again, it's that, the fact that she isn't contrived, and you sort of see her soulfulness. And so for me, again, that song kind of communicates that, is just the earthiness and soulfulness and her being, you know, and her talking about that obviously for other people, that beauty is just you being who you are.
And surely that kind of positive message must be a big part of the album's success. We talked about how Blue is maybe more of a melancholy album.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then perhaps Tapestry is maybe somewhat more uplifting, and maybe that is a big part of kind of why it's sold 25 million copies at this point.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, one of the pieces of negative feedback I found out about this song was the use of synthesizers on the track.
Right, okay.
So they certainly don't dominate proceedings, I didn't think.
No.
But again, James Perrone, who I've brought up a few times now, he argues that the synthesizer makes it all sound synthetic and it detracts from the song's message about being real. Do you kind of understand where he's coming from there, or...?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I suppose if you think about it, it's never jumped out at me, so it's never something I've thought, oh, that shouldn't be there. But yeah, I mean, I suppose if he points it out that song is organic and is about being real, and I would say I would have left the synthesizers out. Not that I'm about to start criticizing Tapestry, let's be honest.
So we'll move on to the next track, which is Way Over Yonder. So if we're talking vinyl, this is kind of the end of side A.
Uh-huh.
And there's kind of a real, almost like a gospel feel to this one. And it's one of many songs on the album that's getting a new lease of life in Beautiful, the Carole King musical, which is going to be touring the UK later this year. I mean, the fact that there's a musical with her music, it must be testament to the enduring quality of not just Way Over Yonder, but indeed all of these songs that we're talking about. Are you planning on checking out the musical, or...?
Do you know, now you've reminded me about it. I remember hearing about it a while ago and thought, oh, that would be great. And then now you've reminded me about it, I may well do that. I've got a few gigs that I'm going to plan this year. So I don't know, I enjoy musical theatre. I don't really think my husband loves it that much, but I might have to find a friend to go with.
So there were a collection of demos released in 2012 that included a demo of Way Over Yonder. So Lisa Marie Ferrier said that without production flair, that Way Over Yonder is the most intimate performance on the collection. Do you find the song itself, I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to the demo, but do you find the Tapestry version, do you find that an intimate performance, or do you think that's maybe something that's more for the demo?
I think it is, in that I think her vocal is pretty intimate on the track. I think that kind of brings you in. And again, she doesn't over-sing it. You know, she kind of, especially at the start of the track, she sings it pretty... intimately would be quite a good way to describe it. So yeah, I think so.
So we'll move on to arguably, and I always say arguably because I don't like to be definitive, arguably the most well-known song on the album, which is You've Got a Friend.
Arguably one of the most well-known songs ever.
Yeah, yeah. So on our episode about Sweet Baby James, we spoke a bit about You've Got a Friend with Bruce Carroll when we were talking about the James Taylor song Fire and Rain. So obviously there's a correlation between these two songs. James Taylor had said that Carole King told him the song was a response to a line in Fire and Rain. So, I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. There's a really strong friendship between the two of them. I was wondering if you could just take a minute just to kind of talk about that. I mean, it's still an enduring friendship to this day, from what I can see.
I know. Oh, it's just so lovely. And actually, I didn't know that. That's a new piece of information to me, that it was sort of a response, and that's so nice. Like, that almost makes it even more endearing, if that's possible. And I think because knowing the love that exists and still exists between the two of them. And I mean, imagine writing those two songs almost as like a call and answer. That's just pretty epic. That's just absolutely lovely. And to say something to your friend or someone you love in the form of such a beautiful song is really just so amazing. And I've heard him, heard James Taylor speak about, he was quite funny at the gig I was at, and he said, when he heard Carole sing it, and he describes You've Got a Friend as the best, the most perfect pop song ever written. And he said, when I asked Carole if I could record it, he was like, I didn't realise I'd be singing it every day of my life for the rest of eternity. But and he was like, oh, you know, this song's opened so many doors for me. This was the one that was the biggest hit for me, blah, 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 and all those things. So he's really, it was just very, obviously very extremely important song for him as well. But what a lovely story. I just think, like, it's great. And again, it's just simple. It's not trying to be clever. It's not trying to be, you know, cool. It's not contrived. It's just telling a friend that you're there for them, that you love them, and that you'll be there no matter what. And it's just the nicest message anyone can ever hear.
It's just really pure. I think that's the word I would use. It's just a really pure song. And again, it's kind of just that idea before we move on. It's if you put almost the two lines together, and you were saying, is it kind of a like an answer to Fire and Rain? I've seen lonely times where I could not find a friend.
Yeah.
You've got a friend. Like, yeah. It's just lovely. It's so simple, like you say.
I know. It's nearly making me cry, that. Lovely.
So, we've been talking about James Taylor's version of the song. So, he recorded it himself for his third album, Mudslide, Slam and the Blue Horizon. And they were both actually recorded simultaneously. Carole King, Danny Kochmar, and Joni Mitchell perform on both recordings of the song. I know you're a James Taylor fan, and I don't want to ask you this question. How hard is it for you to pick a definitive version of the two?
I don't really think you can, because they're just both equally as lovely. I mean, James singing it, I have to say, James singing it, there's just that, like, really, he has got a very pure voice as well, and I think he's got, you know, you feel that tenderness in there, I suppose, from the James Taylor version for me. But again, Carole, she's the same, and she's got that lovely, pure quality. So I don't know, I can't pick.
I guess the problem is they're so interwoven, aren't they? And they're so kind of, you almost like can't have one without the other, even though they're like different songs.
Exactly.
So, I mean, James Taylor's version won the Grammy for Best Male Pop Vocal Performance, and Carole King won the Grammy for Song of the Year.
Yeah.
And it's been covered so many times. And as we've both touched on, for me, it's my favourite on the album. It's the definitive Carole King song. What is it about You've Got a Friend? And I think we've touched on this a bit already, that's made it such an enduring and beautiful song for so many people.
I think, again, you know, it's that universal longing for someone to say that to you, you know, that that whatever you go through, you're not alone, you know. And I think for all of us, that's just, we all need to hear that, all of us. And again, I think that's what's made it so, it just connects so universally, because there's that hunger, you know, that universal hunger for hearing that, and from someone who means it, you know. So
if we move on to the next track, which is Where You Lead, this is the second of two songs where the lyrics were written by Toni Stern. King had written the music and the majority of the lyric for Where You Lead when she kind of asked for Stern's assistance, saying, I can't write the bridge to this. If you can figure out the bridge, you get a co-writing credit. For what I can gather, though, some of the lyrics were further changed as well. Do you notice, and I'm not saying kind of that one's better than the other, when you're kind of listening to the album all the way through, can you notice kind of a difference from songs that were written lyrically by Stern as opposed to King's? Do they kind of jump out at you?
For me, they don't, actually. Maybe other people they do, but for me, they don't. I mean, I feel that the album is really seamless, in a way, which is a seamless tapestry. and I think it is seamless, and it just, everything flows so perfectly. I don't think there's anything that really jumps out or makes you go, oh, you know, that was weird, or that is very different. So I wouldn't notice. I don't think I would know necessarily if you didn't tell me which songs or who kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got to say, I mean, obviously, the first thing I do before I do any research is I listen to the album without kind of all this information going on in my head.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I wouldn't have said that I would have known either. So,
no, exactly, no. Yeah.
So there has been a bit of controversy surrounding the lyrics of Where You Lead over the years. So our good friend James Perrone, who I've mentioned a few times, he says that the lyrics could suggest that the song reinforces stereotypes that a woman should please her husband over her own aspirations. And in fact, Carole King didn't perform the song live for a long time for this reason and ended up rewriting it in 2000. Do you find kind of a chauvinistic message in the song, or do you think people are reading too much into it?
Well, I mean, I suppose for me, like in my marriage, like I think in a healthy relationship, you know, you effectively take it in turns. Like sometimes, you know, my husband will go, no, let's go in this direction. And I'm like, yeah, let's go in that direction. In fact, in our situation, I could probably do with doing that a bit more. But then other times, you know, I'll go, no, you know. So it's not that it's always wrong. I mean, and I think, you know, you don't want to be like, I could never be led by someone, because I think that's good at times. But yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be if it was suggesting it. I've probably never thought about it in that much depth. I've not absolutely analysed the lyrics to that song, but I suppose if it was saying that, like, you know, that's how it was all the time, or that's how it had to be, then, you know, then that wouldn't be healthy. But I think if it's just more saying, you know, that may be how you feel at that moment, then that's okay.
So as I just briefly mentioned, the song was re-recorded in 2000 by Carole and her daughter Louise Goffin for theme of the TV series Gilmore Girls.
Right.
So from what I can gather, the producers of the show had asked if they could use the original song, and she said that she would rather rewrite it and record a new version. So the lyrics were reworked to be more about the relationship between a mother and a daughter rather than husband and wife or boyfriend and girlfriend. Have you heard the Gilmore Girls version, for lack of a better term? And is it an improvement on Tapestry's version?
I actually haven't heard it, so I can't comment on that.
That's fair. I mean, like I say, I mean, I haven't either, actually, but it was just quite interesting that it's kind of changed so much. And, I mean, the new version was performed at the Hyde Park show last year, where Carole King performed Tapestry in its entirety, and she chose to perform the new version with Louise. And she said the following to the audience. She said, "The next song I don't perform very much. It came out just before Women's Lib, and it's got a kind of Stand By Your Man lyric. So I didn't exactly feel comfortable performing it." The song has this kind of interesting history, which I just thought was pretty cool to bring up.
Yeah, that is interesting, yeah.
We're getting towards the end of the album now, with Will You Love Me Tomorrow. Now, this is one of a few songs on the album that was previously written with the kind of the Goffin King partnership.
Yeah.
And it started life as a song by the Shirelles. It was the first song by an all-girl group to reach number one in the US.
Yeah.
And it's another song on this album with this kind of all-star band of James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, Russ Kunkel, Danny Kochbar. How do you think that Carole King takes a song that, fair enough, she wrote it, it's her voice, but how she takes a song and she makes it her own, despite the fact that it had been a hit 10 years previous? How do you think she does with that?
I just think brilliantly, and again, that song is a very raw kind of heart cry, and again, I think that makes kind of like I well up when I listen to that song. And you know, I heard a version in, obviously, a number of years ago that the late Amy Winehouse did as well, and I think again she was a vulnerable character, and I think when you hear whenever I hear people sing that song, I just think it's so emotional, and it's a very vulnerable song. And I think Carole King does very well in communicating that honesty and I suppose in a way vulnerability, you know, in her voice and in her musical performance, just because of, as we've discussed, her sincerity and her honesty. And and I think that song is very sincere and very honest, and sort of heart-wrenching.
And I think you're really kind of hitting the nail on the head that musically, compared to kind of the Shirelles version, it's a much more melancholy take on the song. Do you think, and like I say, I mean, this song was written in the early 60s, do you think that part of that could be a reflection on the fact it's been recorded after the breakdown of her marriage, and that the song almost carries kind of an additional message that it did from when it was written?
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so.
So the musical, just to jump back to that for a second, just kind of a little tidbit before we move on. It seems to indicate what we're saying, that kind of the emotional relationship she has with this song is kind of pivotal throughout the musical. So it's actually performed four times throughout. So from what I can gather, the first time the character of Carole King is recording it as a demo, there's a version of the Shirelles singing it, right through to when she's singing it during a troubled time in her marriage. So I think the musical's picked up on that really well, that this song is a really kind of good, almost plot device, I guess, in terms of a musical to kind of put across how she was feeling at different points in her career.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So the next track on the album is Smack Water Jack. It's another Goffin King composition, but it's one, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I couldn't see if this had been recorded previously by anyone.
Yeah, not to my knowledge.
No. So it tells the story of the outlaw Smack Water Jack and Big Jim the Chief. Now, certainly, it's not a personal song like the rest of the album. Do you feel it kind of still fits in with the flow of Tapestry as a whole?
I think it does, and I think, I suppose, it's for me, it's always just, it's like a slightly more lighthearted moment in a way, like, just because it's not that, just because it's a more fictional story, if you like, and it's not, or it's not a direct heartfelt song the way that our other songs are, that are very just singer songwriter based and emotional. I think the album needs that change in direction at that point, you know. It just, or not needs it, but is benefited by it, because it's just a slightly different flavor, I suppose, at that time in the album.
Now, it's a really good example of that great songwriting partnership that they had, but again, and I seem to touch on this a lot, it's another great example of all the fantastic musicians who play on this album. AllMusic's Stuart Mason calls it a fan favourite, but accuses it of being perhaps a bit lightweight. Now, I think you've kind of touched already that maybe the album needs that at this point. That, you know, when we were talking about Blue with Samantha Price, I kept touching back on another album we've covered, which is Time Out of Mind by Bob Dylan.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've heard that album.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, a fantastic album, but it just kind of just sort of sink and sink and sink into this lower and lower descent. And it needs something to kind of lift it up. And no. I think that's what Smackwater Jack does in this case. Would you? It's kind of it's just something just to kind of a bit more lighthearted, a bit less personal, and it's just it more than
really
kind of.
I would really agree, and I think Carol has a very, very light-hearted side to her and a joyful side to her that I think, you know, you need to see that you know, more light-hearted element. I think that's important, a bit more of a fun element, I suppose, and I think it's just the perfect moment in the album for that, and I think you kind of need, I think it's needed at that point.
So we've now come to the title track on the album, obviously Tapestry. It's somewhat, lyrically I felt, it was somewhat more of an abstract song in comparison to kind of the rest of the album. Do you have your own interpretation of the song at all?
I don't know. I mean, I think, I don't know. It's a song I enjoy, but I don't know if I've got a particular interpretation of it. I love the analogy, the Tapestry analogy, just in general. And, you know, seeing, just, I don't know, there's something, I suppose, even relating it to the artwork and the cover, you know, there she is just that, like, 70s girl, the way she's dressed and, you know, and her music and her soulfulness and her naturalness and all these things we've discussed. And I suppose that, to me, the title track sort of relates to her, just again, who she is and you know, is a good analogy for, you know, her as a person and the record as a whole.
And it's funny, as I was going to say, that kind of, particularly that, the opening line, that metaphor, my life has been a rich tapestry of rich and royal hue. That sums up her life and the album up to that point really well.
That's it, exactly.
I mean, it's kind of difficult when it's sort of abstract like that. In that sense, it could possibly be a more autobiographical song that's kind of wrapped up in metaphor.
I think so, I think that's quite likely.
So we'll move on to the final track on the album, last but not least. You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Again, it's another iconic song written by Goffin and King. And I'd say arguably the most known version of that was, of course, recorded by Aretha Franklin, who it was written for a 1967 album, Lady Soul. And I've read that the song was inspired by Atlantic Records co-owner and producer Jerry Wexler, who recounts in his autobiography that he'd been mulling over the concept of the natural man when he drove by Carole King on the streets of New York, and he shouted out to her that he wanted a natural woman song for Aretha Franklin's next album.
Wow, and that's what she came up with.
Yeah, so as a result they added him as a co-writing credit on the song.
Oh really? Oh, that's hilarious. Oh goodness.
So how do you feel that Carole King's version differs from Aretha Franklin's recording of it?
I think Aretha Franklin singing Natural Woman is an example of the perfect song and the perfect singer. You know, you can't really compare it to Carole King's version as such, because again they're just so different, but you know, Aretha just kills it in terms of takes it to a different stratosphere, you know, where she just sings it absolutely incredibly. And there was a lovely Facebook video that was going around recently where Carole King was watching Aretha singing it at some big event or other, and she was just like, her face just watching Aretha sing her song was absolutely priceless. This is a nice place to finish, because this is probably this and You've Got a Friend, but this is arguably, I'm not even sure 100% myself, but probably my favourite song in the album. It is a perfectly written song, absolutely perfectly written. And again, as we've discussed everything from, you know, we've discussed Carol being natural, Carol being, you know, soulful, physical, you know, like connected to our emotions, our sexuality, just her love for her friends, her emotional vulnerability as a woman, you know, all these different things. And I think that song again just really sums that up. But the fact that, you know, she's not just saying I'm this fantastic person by myself, but that, you know, in relationship with you, you make me feel this way, you make me feel good. And for me, I think as well, it's a very grateful song. It's like I'm blessed, or whatever, you know, for want of another word, for having you in my life, and you make me feel like this. And it's just a lovely, you know, a lovely song about being in relationship.
And obviously you were talking about kind of Carole King watching Aretha Franklin sing it. From what I can gather, she performed that song a couple of years ago at the Kennedy Center Honors, where they were honoring Carole King. So yeah. I wonder if that's maybe the performance you'd seen. Obviously, I don't know for sure, but
I think that's what I'm referring to, yeah.
So it's almost become kind of an anthem of female empowerment. It's been covered subsequently by Celine Dion, Mary J. Blige. And I think we've kind of touched, I was going to ask you, I think we've touched on it already, kind of what it is about Natural Woman that causes so many recording artists and music fans and everything to kind of gravitate towards it.
Yeah, I think it's great. Do you know what I like about it as well? It's not a traditional, if it's like, it's not just a female empowerment song as in, you know, women on their own being like, oh, I'm, you know, I'm just completely empowered on my own. And this is something I suppose I think is that all of us are connected to one another, you know, like we're, like, you know, there's a difference for me between being independent, and which is, you know, good to an extent, but also I think it's very important to be interdependent, where we all need one another, you know, in relationship, we all need one another in community, we all need one another in our one-to-one relationships to be who we are. And, you know, and like there's a little quote, I can't remember where I heard it, but that I loved, that was basically saying we find out who we are kind of in the context of our relationships, you know, and we find out who we are in the context particularly of our long-term relationships. And I think for me, Natural Woman kind of hits on that a little bit, that it's not just female empowerment as in an individualistic sense, but is empowering, but it's like in, it's relational. And I think that's like, again, you know, something I feel and that I love about Carole King is that, you know, there is that sense, you know, in songs like Home Again, and as we've talked about, where there's, you know, So Far Away as well, as that longing, that hunger for relationship. And I think with Natural Woman, she just joyfully sings about that, joyfully sings about the joy of being in a relationship, feeling valued, feeling loved, in the context of relationship. And, you know, and again, that's something we all long for, we all hunger for, and it's one of my favourite songs.
So as we've reached the end of the album, Tapestry sold over 25 million copies. It's been cited by so many artists as an inspiration, and Rolling Stone named it the 36th greatest album of all time in 2012. What is it? Why do you think it stood the test of time?
Yeah, I think just to sort of sum up, like, and, you know, we've touched on this a lot throughout the interview, but it's universal themes, isn't it? It's universal themes of you know, longing for home, of longing for a relationship, and it just brilliant musicality, brilliant melodies, a direct and soulful vocal performance, an uncontrived vocal performance, and I think James Taylor just describes it as perfectly as anyone, where, you know, there's no filter, there's, what was he said, no filter, no lens, it's just pure soulfulness. And for me, that's what makes it so great.
Before we get to kind of my final question, Ultimate Classic Rock had this to say about Tapestry last year, which I think just sums up everything we've been saying for the past hour or so. So by singing the songs that made her famous as a songwriter, King found her voice on Tapestry and reclaimed her past. The album is as much about looking back as it is moving forward. It's not just one of the greatest female singer-songwriter albums of all time, it's one of the greatest albums of all time. An era milestone that celebrates its timelessness. Great songs never go out of style. So with that in mind, why is Tapestry your classic album, and why should people check it out?
Yeah, I think it's my classic album, really, for the reasons I've said. And I think she is arguably the greatest female songwriter of all time, I think. And it is a masterclass in songwriting. It's an album with continuity, so, you know, all the way through, it doesn't jar, it doesn't, you know, there's not like nothing seems out of place for me. It's seamless, an absolutely seamless Tapestry.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak to us about Tapestry, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Mike.
A special thanks to Esther for taking time out and sitting with me to chat about her classic album, Tapestry by Carole King. Now, you may have heard Esther and I talk a little bit about a Carole King musical that was currently in the works. Beautiful, the Carole King musical, is currently playing at the Aldwych Theatre, but it's going to be touring the UK from September onwards. They're going to be playing in Bradford, Plymouth, Southampton, Norwich, Southend, Nottingham, Belfast, Wales, Birmingham, Newcastle, Hull, Edinburgh, Manchester, Dublin, Aberdeen, Sheffield, Glasgow, Milton Keynes, Woking, Sunderland, Marlow, Bristol, Ipswich, Stoke-on-Trent, Liverpool, Oxford, Leeds, Darlington and Wolverhampton. I must admit, I didn't realise that that's how long the tour was. I didn't think I'd be reading out cities for that long. But yeah, a huge tour for Beautiful, the musical, the Carole King story. And to find out information, to get tickets, all that sort of thing, get yourself over to beautifulmusical.com. ashtonlane.co.uk. As for Esther O'Connor, her band Ashton Lane are absolutely phenomenal, a great country music group coming out of Scotland. And if you get yourself over to ashtonlaneofficial.com, you can find out anything you need to know about the band, including information about their latest album, Nashville Heart. Jeremy Vine of Radio 2 said, "Fresh, self-assured and original. Esther's music just makes you happy to be alive. What a great talent." An Up Country magazine. So this is an album of the very highest quality in writing, musicianship and production. To say this is an excellent album from Ashton Lane is an understatement. So if you're into country music, Ashton Lane are a fantastic band for you to be checking out. So once again, get yourself to ashtonlaneofficial.com and don't forget to check them out on Facebook as well and give them a like. Okay, so that's pretty much it for another edition of My Classic Album. And I'm very excited for the next couple of months because I feel we've got some fantastic guests and some great albums. So as I said earlier, August's edition will be dedicated to Hysteria by Def Leppard, and Rob Wild from Tiger Tales will be joining me for that. And then September's edition of the podcast will be looking at Blondie's Parallel Lines. And my special guest will be Big Boy Bloater, who is an amazing blues singer. Over the moon that I managed to get Big Boy Bloater on the podcast. So they're the next 2 months worth of My Classic Album. And then in October, we'll be looking at Battle of the Hell. But a bit more info on that as we get closer to the time. So until then, I've been Mike Norris, and I will see you in August. Cheers.